From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Both Bush and Gore have enough delegates to take them over the top and secure their nominations. Today, we'll look at George W. Bush's record on foreign policy. He may not recall the names of world leaders, but when it comes to foreign affairs, he knows the value of his own family's name. Also, with the latest developments in genetics, we'll talk to a biologist who has given up her profession, saying she doesn't want to provide a roadmap for corporations for science for profit. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Their presidential nominations at last secured Al Gore and George W. Bush dug in for the eight-month battle to November. Bush said he's braced for Gore's politics of personal destruction and distortions, while Gore argued Bush's risky tax scheme would hurt the economy. Gore used rhetoric today from Bush's defeated rival John McCain, tying Bush to conservative evangelists. Gore, who supports women's health rights and tighter gun laws, said Bush shares the anti-abortion views of Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, and also is a strong supporter of the National Rifle Association. Both Bush, the Texas governor, and Gore, the Democratic vice president, celebrated last night after anticlimactic primaries in six southern states: Florida, Louisiana, Mississippi, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and Texas, pushed each man well beyond the number of delegates needed to win their party's presidential nominations at the national conventions this summer. Russian troops have seized a southern Chechen stronghold after 9 days of fierce battles and are combing destroyed houses for rebel leader Ruslan Galayev, this according to the Atartas news agency. In a report from Komsolyskoye, located at the mouth of the strategic Argun Gorge, TASS said troops finally took control late Tuesday. Up to 500 of Galayev's fighters seized the city on March 6th in an attempt to break out of the gorge after being defeated there by the Russians. Federal prosecutors will reportedly seek the death penalty for at least one defendant in the deadly U.S. embassy bombings in Africa. The New York Times cites anonymous defense lawyers as saying the death penalty question hinges on approval from Attorney General Janet Reno. The defendant, Mohammed Rashed Daoud al-Owahali, is charged with conspiracy to murder in the 1998 twin bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. He allegedly admitted to riding in the truck that carried a massive bomb to the American embassy in Nairobi. The bombings killed 224 people, including 12 Americans. A death row prisoner who twice escaped from his cell, fought with guards to the end, and stunned authorities during his execution by spitting out a small handcuff key. Panchay Wilkerson mumbled as he spit out the key while lethal chemicals flowed into his body, the secret as of Wilkerson. This according to James Raziel, a chaplain who stood next to the inmate in the death chamber on Tuesday evening. 7 minutes later, Wilkerson was pronounced dead. Wilkerson had struggled with prison guards all day. Hours before the execution, guards had to use a mace-like spray on Wilkerson when he refused to leave his cell at a prison near Livingston for the 40-mile trip to the Walls unit in Huntsville, Texas. Then he refused to leave his holding cell near the death chamber, and guards had to use additional restraints to bind him to the gurney for his execution. Southern African leaders urged Western donors yesterday to cancel Mozambique's $8 billion foreign debt so it can put all its resources into recovering from devastating floods. Nine presidents and prime ministers meeting in an emergency summit also called for a regional institutional mechanism for disaster preparedness and for the international community to promote long-term support for such a mechanism. Floods and a cyclone have killed hundreds of people in Mozambique, South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Botswana since January, and driven more than 500,000 from their homes. France proposed that sovereign debt claims on Mozambique be postponed and said it's ready to cancel the close to $500 million it's owed as soon as other countries agree to a debt relief plan. A senior Pentagon official warned yesterday that U.S. troops in Kosovo this spring may have to fight their former allies, ethnic Albanian guerrillas, who are rearming themselves and threatening cross-border attacks against Serbia. The stern warning came as State Department envoy James Rubin ended 3 days of talks in which he urged ethnic Albanian leaders to halt a rising tide of violence against Serbs, but apparently failed to win any concessions. With increasing frequency in recent weeks, ethnic Albanian fighters have raked Serbian villages and homesteads with gunfire and have assaulted Serbs on the way to work or to marketplaces, an apparent effort to drive the remaining Serbs out of Kosovo. This also comes as a report has been obtained by the Washington Post saying ethnic Albanians in Kosovo's new National Guard engaged in illegal activities and human rights abuses during the force's first 5 weeks of operation this year. This is an internal report that is put out by the United Nations.
When I put a suit that's grand on and I stand like a sycamore, I'm the guy birds would love to land on. I enjoy being Al Gore. You think looking dead's a drag? It's not a thing people would adore. 'Cause you're constantly chased by maggots. Still I love being Al Gore. So try not to cause me any jittering. I'll stand still and try to look like bait. My fear is they'll pick me up for littering when I accidentally start to defoliate. That's a little joke, y'all. Tell the press that Al Gore.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan, back.
Yes.
To the East Coast.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners. Yes, and I'm back from my travels in the West.
Was it particularly mapped for you in your book tour that you would go to all Pacifica cities?
Well, I don't think there's a Pacifica station in Long Beach or San Antonio, but yes, I did go to quite a few, and I want to thank all the listeners from Democracy Now! Who went to many of those shows and who kept on asking me everywhere I went, what's it like to work with Amy Goodman?
And then you suddenly just got this look of bliss that came over your face, and you said, I just can't wait to get back. It's hard to put into words.
Some people even asked what you look like, Amy, and how old you were, so I think that you have several admirers out there across the country.
There is a lot to talk about today, and it's great to have you back. First, I want to commend the Christian Science Monitor that is doing a four-part series. I think today is the third part on East Timor, looking at a particular battalion, Battalion 745, A Brutal Exit, it's called. And it is showing evidence of this one particular Indonesian army unit's direct role in killings in East Timor in the last weeks before the Indonesian army was forced to pull out. It is a series that's done by Cameron Barr, and it traces the battalion, which, according to eyewitnesses, the victims' families, and a former sergeant of this battalion, its troops murdered specific supporters of independence and were ordered to shoot people who came within range of their departing convoy, also responsible for the killing of Monitor contributor Sander Tunis. And I encourage people to read this series. We hope to have Cameron Barr on. Also, major developments in genetics research and also raising very serious ethical questions. We'll go to this in the second segment. The issue of, Blair and Clinton talking about who gets to use the information that'll come from the Human Genome Project, and also the cloning of five piglets in Virginia and all that that means. One of these pigs has been named .com, clearly not named by its mother.
Well, I guess further merger of biotechnology and just plain old internet.
That's right. And it could mean millions of dollars for corporations as they talk about harvesting thousands of pigs for use as organ donors, raising very serious ethical questions. But we're going to get to that in a little while, because right now, first, we're going to talk about some major communications news. The Tribune Company won't need the approval of the Federal Communications Commission to seal its purchase of Times Mirror Company, but the deal does trigger federal rules that prohibit ownership of a broadcast station and daily newspaper in the same locale. Tribune Company's $6.3 billion acquisition of Times Mirror would give its newspapers in cities where it already operates television stations. The FCC's so-called cross-ownership rules ban such combinations in a market. According to agency rules, companies that break the law must dispose of their broadcast station within 1 year or by the time their broadcast licenses come up for renewal, whichever is longer. In the meantime, the FCC is looking at the ownership ban as part of a broader review of its media rules. The agency is considering whether to eliminate it entirely, change it, or keep it as it is. The FCC is expected to complete its review sometime this year. The Newspaper Association of America has urged the FCC to quit enforcing the regulation or at least implement a waiver policy until it can be repealed. We're going to talk about a number of these issues right now. One is Los Angeles Times being taken over by what? The Chicago Cubs?
Tribune.
Which also owns the Chicago Cubs.
Which also owns the Cubs, among many other properties that it owns.
And we're going to talk about the new FCC rulings. We're joined by two people, Jeff Chester from the Center for Media Education, which is an electronic media advocacy organization in Washington, and Robert McChesney, who is a professor at the Institute for Communications at the University of Illinois. He's the author of Rich Media, Poor Democracy. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Robert McChesney and Jeff Chester.
Glad to be here.
Well, it's good to have you both with us. Let us begin with Bob McChesney. Can you talk about the Los Angeles Times being taken over by the Chicago Tribune?
Well, it follows, in one sense, the pattern in media industries, especially newspapers, for the past three or four decades, where chain newspapers have become the order of the day, and the larger the chain, the better, and the more powerful, the better. And generally, the evidence shows that these do not have many benefits for anyone except the shareholders of those companies. There's very little gets passed on to the public. In fact, to the extent there is hard evidence, it points that usually as these companies get bigger and bigger, the localism and the commitment to local news tends to suffer. But this deal is more than simply that, because I think Jeff will be able to talk about this too. This deal is really not just about newspaper companies. It's about a company, the Tribune, which has a very advanced strategy, I think, with merging television, newspapers, and the Internet. And as a result, what this deal is going to do for the Tribune Company is give them the dominant newspaper in the second and third largest markets in the country, and a very important newspaper, as you know, in New York, in Newsday, which dominates Nassau County and has made attempts to get into the city. But it gives them the first three markets in the country with daily newspapers. And, you know, a long time ago, people were writing off, maybe not even a long time ago, writing off newspapers as an antiquated Gutenbergian technology. But now I think the lesson of the Internet is that the traditional media giants have enormous resources that can't be duplicated as things go online. And daily newspapers have tremendous resources and assets that they'll be able to bring to the Internet. And I think they're positioning themselves now to make more deals, get bigger and bigger in the coming years.
Well, I'd like to ask Jeff Chester about this, because I'm very familiar with the Tribune Company. They used to own the New York Daily News, where I've worked for many years. And in fact, I thought that back in 1991, when we had a six-month strike that actually drove Tribune out of New York City, the newsprint business, that we'd seen the last of them. But I guess they're back in New York. But one of the interesting things on this whole issue is the question of this joint ownership of both TV and print, and how Tribune has been developing that in Chicago, where basically it's using the Chicago Tribune reporters to also do TV work, radio work, all of it, of course, without more compensation to them for doing this, and basically using the resources of their print reporters to establish more of a critical mass, I guess, of information. And the term that they've developed for their journalists, which is called content providers rather than journalists. And, of course, in New York, they're talking about now WPIX, which is a Tribune-owned company, a TV station, being able to do joint ventures with Newsday. And in Los Angeles, KTLA, being able to do joint news operations with the LA Times. Are there any ethical questions that are raised by all of this? And what about this issue of the ban on cross-ownership, which After Murdoch bought some of the Fox stations, he got a dispensation, actually, from this, and most people feel that this is the trend now.
Look, you're going to see more and more of these mergers. You're going to see more and more of this cross-ownership, more and more lobbying for this cross-ownership, and more of the entire media industries being much more a commercial, influenced by the role of advertising and marketing. And it's going to be, whether it's newspapers or on the Internet or on television, and they're all going to merge, and that's what's driving these deals. This is an attempt by the largest companies in the world, but let's just look at the U.S., to control all the major outlets. Their model is simply, bottom line, let's make as much money as possible. This trend, unfortunately, is going to continue, and I think that the challenge that people concerned about diversity of information sources, the potential for independent journalism, media that promotes arts and culture both locally and nationally, is to take advantage of the fact that we have a new system coming in. All these deals are being driven by something called broadband, which is the merging, the convergence of all these media through either cable wires or telephone wires or over the air, to create a whole new media system that creates some new spaces. I don't think we're going to change these trends, even though we have to fight them. Now, in terms of cross-ownership, the newspaper industry has been fighting for years to repeal the very important safeguard that now prevents a newspaper in a community from also owning the local station. And my organization was involved, for example, in 1996, forcing the Republicans to take that provision out of the Telecom Act, which is why it's now at the FCC. They wanted to do it in 96, but we were able to stop them. Then, hopefully, we're going to be able to stop them now, but sooner or later, in part because people don't pay attention to the politics of media, don't see media as important as environment and healthcare, even though it's the media that gives us our imagination, our framework for consciousness. There's very little support for these public interest policies in a hugely corrupt system. So you're going to see, journalists are simply peons of these big companies. And as someone who lived in Los Angeles and lived in California, I really do mourn what is about to happen to the Los Angeles Times. It wasn't perfect, but they put resources into the news. They did fantastic investigative reporting. They have a wonderful TV criticism, journalism criticism. And I think you're going to see that stopped slowly but surely by the cost-cutting folks at the Chicago Tribune, who really don't put out a newspaper that someone should be proud of. And just quickly, just want to say, over the years in campaigning for public interest media issues, we've been able to count on the Los Angeles Times' editorial support, in part because they didn't own TV stations. They sold their sort of other media properties, and they tried to look at this just as a newspaper company, and they were very, very fair. Now that they're part, again, of this sort of larger converged environment, I don't think you can expect the Los Angeles Times to do what it did, for example, last year, recommend that television stations have to provide some kind of public interest responsibilities in return for the $70 billion worth of digital spectrum they got from the public.
I wanted to ask about this other development as well, the FCC promoting a trading system to sell the airwaves. As they, the New York Times puts it, the airwaves grow ever more congested with modern wireless communications. The federal government is developing plans to open up the spectrum by, in effect, treating its frequencies as commodities to be bought and sold as routinely as pork bellies or soybeans in the open market. Jeff Chester, what's that all about?
Well, this continues a trend that we've seen for a number of years, and of which goes back historically, of which Professor McChesney is the country's leading expert in how the public interest has never meant anything for the most part, except how the owners of the media can make a dollar. Interestingly, this sort of concept began at the beginning of the Clinton administration that sort of looked at the way companies were trading rights to pollute and tried to bring this kind of quote-unquote marketplace approach to the communications industry. In essence, it also harks back to a Reagan concept that the public interest is only defined in terms of what the public is interested in. In this case, they view it as cash. So it's an absolute... It's a sad commentary that the FCC, which has, by the way, the first Democratic majority in 20 years, these are the Democrats doing this. The Democrats took control of the FCC about 3 years ago.
You mean the FCC commissioners?
That's right. They have 3 out of 5 commissioners. These are the Democrats doing this and the Clinton administration doing this. And instead of preserving a portion of this public resource bandwidth to benefit the public, to open up additional channels of communication, to create new services, and to create funding mechanisms for those services, instead, they're simply saying, okay, you can have it, and if you can afford to buy it, you can use it. But the public is not really benefiting from this in terms of having a media system that is responsive and democratic.
We want to get Robert McChesney's response as well, but we have to break. Jeff Chester with the Center for Media Education. Robert McChesney, author of Rich Media, Poor Democracy. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with them in just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, our guest, Jeff Chester, Center for Media Education in Washington, and Robert McChesney, author of Rich Media, Poor Democracy. Juan?
Yeah, I'd like to ask Bob McChesney, what about the argument that's used often that, yes, there are fewer newspapers now, but the development of cable and then broadband and now, and of course, digital broadcasting is allowing more choices for the public in terms of channels or broadcast frequencies, and so that actually there may be concentration of ownership, but there is a greater variety of programming available to the public.
Well, that's certainly the key argument that's made by these giant media firms when they put together these massive corporate complexes like AOL, Time Warner, and now this deal. The argument is, well, you don't have to worry about the traditional concerns of concentration because there's billions of websites out there and there are cable channels and digital TV. We're just a drop in the ocean in this new media environment. And there's an element of truth to that, obviously. You turn on, if you have cable television or satellite TV, you've got a lot of channels. The Internet's got a ton of websites. The problem with that argument, though, empirically, is that the evidence so far shows that even though we have more and more choices, in theory or more in practice, more and more channels or websites to choose from, the actual production of media content, journalism, entertainment, is increasingly concentrated into fewer and fewer hands. Just having a billion websites out there doesn't really amount to a hill of beans unless they've got the resources and the ability to compete so people can see them and want to use them. In the case of the Internet, for example, the evidence is fairly clear. The traditional media giants, the handful of companies like AOL, Time Warner, and Disney, and Fox, have tremendous advantages over any upstarts at becoming commercially viable Internet content players, as the term is used. So just having the chance to open a website doesn't mean you're going to do it effectively. In fact, the cards are very much stacked against it. Indeed, I would go so far as to say that the Internet, to the extent it has affected our media system so far, has encouraged much greater concentration of ownership rather than more diversity. And as for cable, which has been around for 20 or 25 years, and I think probably all four of us can remember in the 70s, when cable came along, people were going, gosh, 30 channels. The world is going to be so awesome then. We'll have something for everyone. It was really liberated. Cable has really, become entirely the domain of 6 or 7 companies that own wholly or in part 49 of the 50 lucrative cable channels. And the channels basically do 4 or 5 different genres, commercial carpet bombing children, business news, TV reruns, sports and shopping, and a couple others. So it's hardly been this garden of wonderful garden of information and culture, but in fact it's been basically a massive shopping mall.
Jeff Chester, at this point, what can be done?
Well, I want to respond to that because I do think that the developments with the Internet are hopeful and positive, and what we want to do is is maintain that kind of diversity as we move forward. I agree with Bob. The key issue is financing resources. But if we don't have the space open to us, then we won't even be able to reach people. Now, you know, this new the new media system is coming in. It's called broadband. And cable is going to be the dominant provider of the Internet in the future, at least in terms of cities. Right now, the cable industry wants to impose its own model over the Internet where it will get to pick and choose which websites go first and fast and which are available and which are not. That's why a number of organizations, ACLU, Consumers Union, Consumer Federation of America, Media Access Project, my group, Ralph Nader, and others, are fighting a campaign for fair access to the Internet in the future. It's called Open Access Initiative. You can go on any of those websites, but making sure that the next generation of the Internet is open, that they can't discriminate against any kind of content provider, including someone like Pacifica, and that there's space for us to produce is very, very important. It's the major battle.
Well, but space is also related often to position, because I've seen, for instance, here in New York City, Time Warner, the major cable operator, has been pushing the public access channels further and further higher up on the channel spectrum, where people routinely, of course, start with the lower channels, and so they're actually withdrawing more and more from their commitment to public access position that they give these channels.
This is not public access. When we talk about open, we don't have the time to go into this, and I hope you will do a show just on this, but we talk about rules to ensure, as part of the open access movement, that the non-commercial and the civic are placed in a prominent way, you know, within the new system as the commercial entities. And in fact, some communities like Portland, Oregon, have gotten into their cable franchises agreements that 10% of the bandwidth are reserved for civic use, and that the data, the video for that 10% is treated at the same preferential terms as the commercial information. That's very key. So there are a lot of strategies that we can engage in now that are policy-based, that are require activism at the local level, at the state level, at the federal level, to give us some kind of more equitable footing. Look, it's going to be an uphill battle, but this is the time to fight it. Otherwise, the AOL, Time Warner, Disney's, and Chicago Tribune will have the whole thing locked up, and we can't afford to let them have that.
Well, we want to thank you both very much for being with us. Jeff Chester of the Center for Media Education, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, you can go to cme.org or mediaaccess.org if you happen to have Internet access, or you can call at 202-331-7833, and be sure to read Professor McChesney's books, because they tell the history of what happens if you don't do public interest policies at the time.
Professor Robert McChesney, Rich Media, Poor Democracy, where can people get more information on your columns and your book, Communications, Politics, and Dubious Times?
Actually, I have a website, robertmcchesney.com, that has sort of all the information about what I've done and about groups like Jeff's, too. robertmcchesney.com.
I want to thank you both for being with us, and we will certainly continue to pursue these issues.
The world in a minute.
70 stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by Coke, by Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
And you are listening to the CD News Goo.
Selling attitude like goo for the masses. Dump consumption. Lumpin', just a bumpkin to the corporate state. You can't satiate what you can't negotiate. Your will's been snatched, the bill's attached. Flim flam diagram, data jam, handicap caught it.
This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Let's see, what are some of his quotes? One of the people who could be the leader of the world, George W. Bush, when he was speaking to the Greater Nashua, New Hampshire Chamber of Commerce on January 27th, I know how hard it is for you to put food on your family. Ever try putting food on your family, Juan?
not in the last few weeks, no.
But it gets particularly serious when he starts talking about foreign affairs. For example, quoted in The Economist June 12th of last year, George W. Bush says, "It's important to keep good relations with the Grecians." Or on CNN Inside Politics last April, Kosovians can move back in. He's also talked about East Timor, quoted by Maureen Dowd in The New York Times, saying, "If the East Timorians decide to revolt, I'm sure I'll have a statement." Well, We're going to be talking about George Bush in just a few minutes. But first, we are going to talk about another development. And that is the latest in genetics research. We've heard about the quint pigs that were just cloned in Virginia. And we've also heard about the statement yesterday of Bill Clinton and Tony Blair agreeing to openly share data from a groundbreaking project to decode the human genetic pattern, a study that could serve as the foundation for developing new medical cures and preventions. The two countries say they'll share raw fundamental data on the human genome, including the human DNA sequence and its variations, with scientists everywhere. A joint statement urged private companies to follow the lead of government laboratories. The U.S. and Britain and the leading partners in the nonprofit Human Genome Project, which plans to publish a full genetic map on the internet by the year 2003. The information will be free and available to all researchers, say Tony Blair and Bill Clinton. Well, today we're going to talk to a scientific researcher who has reached the pinnacle of her profession, but has decided to end it. She refuses to conduct research, she says, because she believes it's unethical and benefits the biotechnology companies. Her name is Martha Crouch. She's a professor of biology at Indiana University, and we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you talk about your research, your plant research, and why you've decided to take a different course of why you've decided to end your career, as you know?
Yeah. Actually, I quit doing this kind of research in about 1991, so it's been a while since I've done research. I'm going to actually finish it off and leave the university here in a couple months. But it's not a traditional whistleblower sort of action. I wasn't upset with a specific application or incident. It was more a problem, in my opinion, with science as usual, that the type of research that is epitomized in what you've just discussed, the cloned pigs and the Human Genome Project, is turning the world of living organisms into machines. And that, to the extent that organisms aren't machines, trying to fit them into that model causes pain and suffering of everything that's alive, and I didn't want to be a part of that.
Now, in some articles about your the development in your thinking, it harkens back to the period when you first began to be aware of how some corporations were utilizing the research, the basic research that you had done. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I've actually had the opportunity to see quite a bit of the research that my students and I and my colleagues have done be commercialized, which I think was a surprise to me. When I started doing research, I thought of myself as a basic scientist who was getting knowledge and putting it in the wall of information brick by brick. That sort of idea of knowledge as an accumulation of information. And I didn't really think I would see it applied, but when I did see it applied, it was for things like making oil palm plantations more amenable to industrialization so that they were more uniform and could be grown on larger scales and benefit large farmers versus the small farmers who had been growing oil palm before. Or more recently, I saw the types of genes we were studying be used in the Terminator technology. I don't know if you've talked about that, but this patent, actually there's a series of patents by most of the major biotech companies to cause seeds to commit suicide in the second generation so that they can't be replanted. And those kinds of applications that favor the continuing industrialization of agriculture, for example, at the expense of the environment and the peasant farmer, were the only kinds of applications I was seeing coming out of our research. And none of those were things that I anticipated or approved of or really wanted my efforts to be going into. I came to see that as pretty much inevitable, though, with the way that the system is set up.
Well, you know, on Wall Street these days, next to internet startups, there are no group of stocks that have been rising more rapidly than biotech stocks. What is your What are some of your main concerns in terms of the chief dangers that are now on the horizon in terms of genetic engineering and the genetic mapping that is going on in the Genome Project?
Well, you know, it's kind of like the days of exploration of continents and islands and so forth by the Europeans, where there were these vast areas of land with people that already lived there and all kinds of plants and animals, that because of the technologies of exploration and superior military might and so forth were open for exploitation. And so people were going out and laying claim to this island or that continent, turning them into plantations that could then be used for generating revenue for their country. It's the same sort of thing. Now that there's the technology to look at the genetic makeup of organisms and even people who have various characteristics, the companies and the government researchers who are involved in this are looking with that imperialistic eye at these genes and claiming them as their territory, that they can, if simply by the process of discovery, that you can go out and find a gene and determine the sequence of it, you can own that gene, and then you can exploit it for your own profit. So there's huge profit to be made from it. And it's a period of really discovery and exploration of the genome, but with the same kinds of problems of exploitation that are inherent in that view of the world, that everything is there for you to reap the benefit of, damn the consequences.
Can you explain what Blair and Clinton have announced yesterday? And also, wasn't it their representatives who said that you cannot patent the genome?
You know, I'm not sure what was meant by you cannot patent the genome, because I believe that patent law is clear on that, that genes can be patented, that genes from any organism can be patented. So I'm not sure where that came from, that statement. I looked up the news on that yesterday. The idea that the information be free and open for all scientists to use, that's the basic characteristic of science, that when you get new data, you publish it in peer-reviewed journals that then are available for anyone to look at. And so that idea is not particularly path-breaking. The problem was that with the Human Genome Project, there were two efforts going on, one by government-funded scientists, and that information has always been open, and the other by private industry, and that was closed. And private industry was actually moving ahead faster than the public effort at sequencing. So, you know, I'm not really an expert in the area of human genome work, but my understanding is that the idea here is to make a recommitment to the idea that this information be in the public realm, but primarily so that the process can go ahead more quickly, that more scientists have access to the information faster so that it can be commercialized more quickly, so that medicines can be developed and so forth, not so that it can be regulated more carefully or prudently, or that it go ahead with more caution, but that it be promoted to happen more quickly. So in my viewpoint, it sort of depends on how you view the whole technology. It would be as if you were saying, okay, we're going to develop nuclear energy, and it can be either in the private realm or the public realm, and we feel it should be in the public realm because we can do it more quickly and efficiently that way. And you might say, well, that's great, except I have a fundamental problem with nuclear energy. There are things that haven't been solved about it. There are innate problems with it. So from my viewpoint, although I'm usually a fan of having knowledge be public rather than private, in this particular case, I have such deep reservations about the whole idea of thinking about organisms as just bags of genes and as disease being an individual fault that can be fixed through engineering. the basic approach to me is the problem. And so whether it's in the public realm or the private, although it has some consequences, because, of course, we should be able to have more oversight if the information is publicly held. In the long run, it doesn't make a lot of difference to me whether it's the government sequencing and making the sequences available to all scientists or private companies privatizing it.
Professor Martha Crouch, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, a very quick summary question about where you go from here. Professor Crouch still teaches, at least for the next few months, at Indiana University in Bloomington. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. We learned of the story of Martha Crouch in the Corporate Crime Reporter and the Multinational Monitor in a column written by Russell McIver and Robert Weissman called The Nature of the Machine. It began by saying this: imagine this, you study your entire life to reach the pinnacle of your profession. First, you secure an undergraduate degree in biology from Oregon State University, then a PhD in developmental biology at Yale, then on to Indiana University, where you teach and run a lab on the cutting edge of plant research, and you have tenure. You wake up one day and realize by doing the scientific research, you're creating the roadmap for corporations to come in and apply the science for profit, thus destroying the nature that attracted you to the study of biology in the first place. But by this time, you've become well-known in your field. In 1990, your lab gets the cover story in The Plant Cell, the leading journal of the field. But exactly 1 month later, you decide to write an editorial for the same publication announcing such scientific research is unethical, and you'll no longer conduct such research, thus effectively ending your scientific career. That, in a nutshell, is the career trajectory of Martha Crouch, a professor of biology at Indiana University in Bloomington, ending that career in the next few months. Martha Crouch, what are you going to do next?
You know, one of the things that kind of surprised me after being so immersed in high-tech science was how much vibrant and really exciting thinking and research was going on in the alternative sphere. I started thinking about what would agriculture look like if the primary purpose of it was to promote a relationship with plants and the land and feed people rather than feed corporate profit. And I found that there was a community of people doing things like developing permaculture, the Land Institute in Kansas, various indigenous groups around the world rediscovering their traditional agricultures and so forth, that were addressing problems in a holistic way that was really exciting. I'm amazed at the creativity, talent, and vibrant energy of people in the alternative agricultural world, and I've become part of that world and am connected with people who are trying to reinvent agriculture along more holistic lines. It's really quite exciting.
And you don't feel you can do that as a professor at Indiana University?
You know, very, very little of that kind of research goes on in universities. And there are a lot of reasons for that. One of them is it's extremely interdisciplinary. And the reward systems are set up in most universities to reward work within a discipline. And if you work outside of that, it has to be a tangent to your main work. So it's really hard to do that kind of I guess, undefinable research in a university setting.
And what's been the reaction of your colleagues in the scientific community to your developing, continually developing critique of what's going on in research and science?
Mainly it's been marginalization. You don't have to think very differently from the mass of your colleagues to be completely marginalized. And to go as far as I've gone, basically I've become invisible to my colleagues. And when I do show up at a debate or something like that, then, you know, they have to deal with the ideas, but often we're speaking from such different worldviews that the ideas just whiz past each other up above our heads somewhere. It's really been difficult to connect in any direct way with my former colleagues.
Professor Crouch, if people want to get in touch with you, how can they?
Well, probably the best way is email, crouch@indiana.edu.
That's C-R-O-U-C-H.
Right.
At indiana.edu.
Right.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, and we hope to hear from you soon with all sorts of new discoveries and explorations that you're involved with outside of the academic world.
Well, I hope so. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for being with us. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
On a fine-looking Sunday, most people agree it's no big sin to sit on our butts drinking beer while we're watching some pigskin. We Washington locals don't like Texas yokels. They're such a bizarre bunch of guys. The question we're saying while Dallas is playing is, will the defendant please rise?
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! From the CD, Unzippin' My Duda, the Capital Steps, as we move now to Texas and further south as well to Argentina. There was a piece in Mother Jones Magazine, Don't Cry for Bush, Argentina. George W. may not recall the names of world leaders, but when it comes to foreign affairs, he knows the value of his own family's name. And it begins, Texans watch with interest last winter as Governor George W. Bush was homeschooled on international affairs by former Secretary of State George Shultz and other veterans of his father's foreign policy team. Even Carl Bildt, the former prime minister of Sweden, was brought in for a tutorial at the governor's mansion in the hope that his recent UN experience in the Balkans could help Bush understand that Kosovars are not Kosovarians and that Greeks are not Grecians. But no one had to prepare a prompt card to remind him who stepped down as president of Argentina in December. We're joined right now by one of the authors of this piece, Louis Dubose. Don't Cry for Bush, Argentina. Can you tell us about George W. Bush's connection to Argentina?
I can, Amy. George W.'s connection to Argentina went way back beyond the golf game that was played in Austin last year. And as a matter of fact, the Bush family has been all over Argentine business and oil fields. The piece that the story that we focused on has to do with a call in 1988 on behalf of the company Enron, which is the world's largest pipeline company, and is based in Houston, and has invested $525,000 in Governor Bush's short political career in Texas. There was at the end of the military dictatorship, Raul Alfonsín took over, of course, in Argentina, and struggled with an economy that was out of control. Tried to keep the troops in the barracks and finally was working on some final, at the end of his tenure, was working on some final privatization efforts, one of which was a large gasoducto, which would connect Argentine gas fields with gas fields in other South American countries. It was a $300 million project. Two companies were involved and had been involved for quite some time, an Italian company, ENI, and Perez Compaq, an Argentine company, was working in partnership with Dow. At the very end of this process, the bidding process, a representative from Enron appeared in the offices of Rodolfo Terraño, who was then the Minister of Public Works and has got to be one of the great stand-up guys in the Western Hemisphere, because Enron showed up with a one-page, double-spaced bid on a very complex contract, which included what Minister Taranio called, described as a laughable price for natural gas, because Enron was naming its price for natural gas, and they wanted to get in on the bidding at the very end. There was a full court press put on by Ambassador Gildred, a Florida developer, a California developer appointed by Reagan. There was a lot of arm twisting, and then there was a phone call to Rodolfo Taranio by Vice President George Bush, by the son of Vice President George Bush, George W. Bush. Vice President Bush had just was about to be elected president. He and George W. called the Argentine Public Works Minister and said that I'm calling on behalf of Enron, and I think it would be better for Argentine U.S. relationships if this company would get that contract. And Taranio said no. And that's the story in a nutshell.
Now, this is according to Taranio's recollection of what occurred, right? Because the G.W. Bush people have denied that he ever made such a phone call?
In all fairness to George W. Bush, he has denied it twice. And in all fairness to David Korn of The Nation, who did a brief take on this story in 1994 during the election, he denied it to David first. We decided to further explore it and to go back to Taranio, and with Carmen Coiro, a wire service reporter that I know in Buenos Aires, we started looking into what was into the Bush's work in the work of the Bushes in Argentina. Some of this is also documented by Argentina's really best investigative journalist Horacio Verbitsky. So the governor has Governor Bush has now twice said that he did not make this phone call, but there's a pattern. I mean, his brother was working in Argentina at the same time. Neil was selling was prospecting for oil in Argentina using money, or previously actually using money from the Colorado savings and loan collapse, $1 million in credit from Silverado, Denver.
I think a lot of people have forgotten that is George W. Bush's brother, Neil Bush,
brother.
Implicated in the whole Silverado savings and loans scandal.
That's his brother, yeah, Neil Bush, who was banned forever from practicing banking in this country because of his role in Silverado in Denver.
How much did that cost taxpayer?
I don't recall, Amy. It was one of the big ticket items, though.
But you've uncovered continued involvement of the Bushes. What happened subsequently to that after Taranio turned down the Enron last minute bid?
Well, he said no, and then the embassy really put on Taranio was not so let me say a word about Rodolfo Taranio. He fled. He had enough public integrity in his work as a journalist that he had to flee the country for 10 years during the dictatorship before Alfonsín was elected. He came back to work for Alfonsín and is now the chief of President De La Rúa's cabinet, the new president who has succeeded President Carlos Menem. So at the time of the when we along with The Nation ran this story in 1994 in an abbreviated version, Karl Rove called me. Karl Rove, who is now George Bush's chief campaign strategist, he called. He must have called at the time the issue arrived at his office because it was midday on Saturday. He called me in a rage.
You working at the Texas Observer?
I was at the Observer. Yeah, we ran it simultaneously, or maybe a few days ahead of The Nation because of publication schedules. And there was an election going on here at the time, which was really what set Karl Rove off. He was running Bush's campaign against Ann Richards. This was very late in the campaign. But, Karl called screaming, and, this is up to then. He had thought even the Texas Observer had some journalistic standards, and now we're listening to some guy in Argentina. Well, some guy in Argentina just happens to be today the number two in command, or number one in command of the Argentine cabinet, and really an incredible public servant on his own right. But he was later under full court press by a lot of pressure by the American embassy, which wrote him a very threatening letter, implying that U.S. investments would be pulled out, that there are a number of U.S. investors lined up, and unless Argentina played ball with the U.S. Embassy, these investors were going to withdraw their bids to buy into the privatization projects that were going on in Argentina. And this was a subsequent administration because President Alfonsín was out, but they put huge pressure on the Menem administration early on to sort of define who they were, the Bush administration, and what their relationships were. And when I called Governor Bush's press spokesman recently and asked what the governor's role in this was, when his ambassador, Todman, subsequently the next ambassador, pressured the government to open the door to U.S. businesses, he said Governor Bush knew nothing about it. However, However, President Bush had been in Argentina 2 days before the Todman letter, which was leaked and published all over the Argentine press. He'd been there 2 days before the Todman letter was written, and it's a real example, I think, of how globalization actually works when the doors are closed Minister of Public Works is in a headlock with the U.S. Embassy working him over. It's not just unseemly. I mean, it sort of borders on illegal.
And how many times did President George Bush visit Argentina in his?
We've tracked down about a half dozen times. Most recently, while we were working on this story, President Bush showed up what Carmen Coiro, who is really a fine reporter, called me as our story was closing.
We just have a minute to go.
Okay, and there was Governor Bush, President Bush's airplane had showed up at the airport, and he was meeting with bankers and big deal makers in Argentina. So
right after President George Bush left office, wasn't one of his trips to Argentina where he got some millions of dollars from Sun Young Moon in Argentina?
There was the Moon connection in Argentina, and I think that there's a lot more to be told about the Bushes in Argentina, including his dealings on behalf with Raul Moneta, a fugitive banker who came out of hiding several days after Bush left there. President Bush left there recently, and who is a major investor with Tom Hicks, who is the chair of Hicks Muse, which is a company in which the Bushes are invested, and Tom Hicks is the chairman of is a regent that George W. Bush, Governor Bush, appointed to the University of Texas Board of Regents.
And
so there are a lot of interesting connections.
And as you talk about Enron, Kenneth Lay, the company's chief executive, Enron gaining a lot from its involvement in Argentina, from pressure from the Bushes. George W. has a long relationship with Kenneth Lay. He personally contributed $100,000 to Bush's two gubernatorial campaigns. And when Bush announced he was running for president, executives and political action committees connected to Enron contributed close to $90,000 to his campaign. And Lay signed on as Bush pioneer, pledging to raise $100,000.
Yeah, they're big Bush underwriters, and they have James Baker, the former Secretary of State, is an Enron drummer. He's a salesman for Enron.
And did Enron finally get the contract in Argentina?
No, they didn't. The whole deal collapsed, and they ultimately own a small piece of the contract. Not for lack of trying, but the deal did
get Menem to agree to sign a presidential decree that included Enron in a national program freeing it from tariffs and value-added taxes.
Enron got a huge tax breaks in Argentina and really pressured Menem, who is Governor Bush's golf buddy now. They really pressured President Menem, one of the more corrupt presidents in Latin America. They persuaded him to include them in what a program that was really designed for domestic industries.
Louis DeBose, I want to thank you for being with us. The piece in Mother Jones Magazine, Don't Cry for Bush, Argentina. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love and Maria Carrion with help from Sputnik Colombi. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!